This is the third day of this July 2010 7-day Sesshin, and we'll be resuming our reading from the teachings of 12th century Chan master Mumon, whose posthumous name given to him by the emperor is Foyan. And the text is called Instant Zen. Boy, that's a publisher's title if ever you want to hear one. Instant Zen, just like that. Who wouldn't want that book? Who wouldn't want to buy that book? And he begins, I tell people to get to know the self. But seekers who hear this equate it with what beginners see and think there is nothing hard to understand about it. You should take it more slowly for a while and be more careful. What do you call the self? And this is, of course, a fundamental inquiry. To know the self, to really know the self experientially, is to know what things are, to know reality. When he says seekers who hear this equate it with what beginners see, he may be referring to a kind of a just getting more knowledge about our unique character or personality. Don't need to tell anyone here that self-analysis is the opposite of what we want to do in our sitting. Things come up, of course. This is one of the many things we harvest from Sesshin is insights into our personality and our character, our vulnerabilities. Our ego is on full display in Sesshin, isn't it? We see so much more than we ordinarily do, more than we would ever want to. But this isn't the self that Wu Men is talking about here. It's not the self. Our true self is beyond this small self, this personhood that we've carried with us through our lives. It's beyond that, but it's not separate from it. Our true self manifests itself through this particular person, each one of us. Our particular temperament is how it manifests itself at any given moment. Our job is not to eliminate anything about our personality or character, but to see through it and see that it is no other than this true self that is no self. When he says you should take it more slowly for a while and be more careful, he's really urging us to look. Most people go through their lives without ever really, truly looking nakedly at oneself. The more closely we look, and there's no better way to examine this self than in Zazen, the more closely and deeply we see into it, the more mysterious it becomes. The more we find that we don't know this self. We certainly see our patterns, we see our habits, not just our behavioral habits, but our mental habits, our emotional reactive habits. But we also come to see how much of what we think of as I is based on the past. Memories, images based on past experiences, self-images, images that others reflect back to us. We come to see that actually, what we think of as the I or the me has no roots to it. There's no substance to it. It's all ideas, thoughts, concepts. So when the great Bodhidharma was asked by Emperor Wu, "Who is standing before me?" Bodhidharma could only say, "I don't know." What freedom to not know. Before I moved to Rochester and got on staff, I was living in Ann Arbor, and I was working for about a year at a psychiatric hospital. And and that is on the ward of a big hospital there. And I was enlisted to be the subject of a little training session for one of the psychiatry residents, and he was to present the way he interviewed someone. So we set this up, and there were others. There were actual licensed psychiatrists from the hospital there watching, looking on while he interviewed me. Poor guy, he was so nervous, and I was only too happy to talk about myself at the time, and about all of the things that were, I was so confused about myself, and so much pain about my confusion, and what I didn't understand about myself, what I didn't like about myself, and I went on for quite a while, and this guy was listening, and finally, at the end, he said, well, Peter, I really think you just don't know who you are. It was right, of course. That's not Bodhidharma's I don't know. Hakuin famously said, I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the wide, wide earth. And the Buddha, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world-honored one. He goes on, how about the sayings of ancient worthies on the self? And then there's some quotations here he presents. Roaming the mountains, enjoying the rivers. That's the end of the quote. Then he says, you say, I understand. Who else is it? Another saying goes, it is yourself. You say, I understand this too, it is myself. But how about the reply, mountains, rivers, the whole earth? It is also said, when you eat, the meal is yourself. How do you understand that? You still can't get to it. An ancient worthy said, the whole earth is yourself. So how can you clear your mind? How can you clear your mind so that you can realize this for yourself, that the whole earth is yourself? It's an illusion, this notion of a separate self. It's like a this hologram that is gives the appearance of substantiality through the working of laser beams, optics. It looks like a person there. Probably everyone here has seen a hologram in a museum or something, but there's nothing there. It's a perfect example of how this true self is no self, or the illusory nature of this so-called separate self. The larger point is that we are deceived by appearances. This is core Buddhist experience. or deceived by appearances. We move through this world of objects, and everything seems so substantial, but our perception is limited. We only see the appearance. In fact, it is all just different forms of energy in flux, starting with our own self, the seer. But oh, how we cling to this image, this illusion, this idea. Nurture it, we fortify it with all of the forms of identification, all the forms of my, we were talking about yesterday, my opinions, my religion, my political party, my city, my sports team. It's all to fortify this illusion, because we know at some level of the mind, we know there's nobody there. There's nobody of any substance. And this, because we don't really know it through our own experience, this sets up a state of basic anxiety. And we layer this illusion, this hologram, with all of these forms of identification. He goes on, whenever I see that people have misunderstood, I quote ancient stories to question them. For example, Jing Qing asked Xuanzha, I have just entered this temple. Please point out a way in. Xuanzha said, do you hear the sound of the valley stream? Jing Qing replied, yes. Xuanzha said, enter from here. Jing Qing got the message from this. I ask you, when he heard, what did he hear? Everyone says he heard the sound of the water, but what use is such an interpretation? According to their view, the hearing clearly takes in everything at once, so there is no sound to be found apart from this hearing. Everything being a manifestation from one's subjectivity, it is representation of active consciousness. So in other words, a lot of intellectualizing about it. Some answer that it was not the sound of water he heard, but his self. To this I say, how can the self hear the self? An early teacher said, this is Wei Neng, the sixth patriarch, is it the wind ringing or is it the chimes ringing? So this is a variation on the flag koan that we mentioned yesterday. Is it the wind ringing or is it the chimes ringing? He should have stopped right there, but he went on to vex others by saying, it is not the wind or the chimes ringing, but only your mind ringing. The ancient teacher gave this testimony. Why don't you understand? Just because of subject and object. That is why it is said, the objective is defined based on the subjective. Since the objective is arbitrarily defined, it produces your arbitrary subjectivity, producing difference where there was neither sameness nor difference. in Affirming Faith in Mind, we chant, if all thought objects disappear, the thinking subject drops away. For things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. How can you really divide subject and object? Really? In the last century, science, physics began catching up to this ancient Buddhist teaching, and that the Heisenberg principle, the uncertainty principle, that anything, everything we observe or perceive is influenced by the observer, the perceiver. There is no object that is separate from subject. This really pulled the rug out from traditional science. You see this principle working all through the koans, where a monk will ask about the truth or reality as if it's something out there. That's what Heisenberg famously said. There's no out there, out there. The masters knew this. They knew that it's anything that we can conceive of as apart from us is an abstraction. It's not real. It's an abstraction that we've concocted in the mind. And so they would respond to each individual, recognizing that the individual was also it, whatever truth the questioner, he or she was talking about. You can't tease them apart. It's not a thing out there anywhere. It's the very act of hearing, speaking. It's this. Over and over again, you read in the old records, the master is saying, just this. This. Not something anywhere else. He goes on, you get up in the morning, get dressed, wash your face, and so on. You call these miscellaneous thoughts, but all that is necessary is that there be no perceiver or perceived when you perceive, no hearer or heard when you hear, no thinker or thought when you think. This is more just pure Buddhist teaching. There's no subject apart from the object. There's no hearer apart from what is heard. There is just the hearing. There's no self who's hearing. It's just the hearing. This is the great mystery. If there is no one here, if there's no self, then who is hearing? How can that be? Surely there must be someone hearing, feeling, tasting, look. What is it? What am I? What is Mu? Buddhism is very easy and very economical. It spares effort, but you yourself waste energy and make your own hardships. This phrase, this vocabulary is very common in the Chinese Zen texts, this of wasting energy or conserving energy. We certainly waste energy by dwelling in our thoughts. And we conserve energy when we refrain from dwelling in our thoughts. We all get the evidence of this at the end of a sesshin when every person without exception feels this buoyant energy, this wonderful sense of energy. It's just from not dwelling as much as we normally do in our thoughts. And most people begin feeling that well before the end of sesshin. It's very, very sobering to realize how much energy we squander with this restless mind of grasping, going, turning this way, that way. We scatter our energies normally. In sesshin, we conserve them, we draw them in, we focus them. There are senior students of a certain type who say, "I do not reason, I make no calculations. I am not attached to sound and form. I do not rely on either the impure or the pure. The sage and the ordinary mortal, delusion and enlightenment, are all completely empty. There are no such things in the great light." And then Wu Men says, "They are shrouded by the light of knowledge, attached to an extreme of knowledge. This is irremediable. They're beyond help." Listen to this. They are shrouded by the light of knowledge. Most people think of knowledge as a wonderful thing to acquire. The light of knowledge, how wonderful. But it is our knowledge, or rather our clinging to what we think we know about ourselves and the world and life and death and reality. It's our knowledge that clouds us. This isn't to say, of course, that there's not a place to learn and to know how to function in one's work and other things. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about our habit of, we were saying earlier, of clinging to notions about ourself and others. You can imagine what radical teaching this was in ancient China, where learning was held up as the highest value. To be a learned man, to be a government official, to have knowledge. In the Confucian ethos of the time was the most you could ever hope for. Memorizing the text, the great Confucian texts. And then along come these Zen masters who say, "Bah! Get rid of everything you think you know. Strip it away. It's not unknown in our own culture. Something in the Bible about if you would enter the kingdom of heaven, you must become like a child. And he goes on, why do you waste energy? Sometimes I observe seekers come here expending a lot of energy and going to great pains. What do they want? They seek a few sayings to put in a skin bag. What relevance is there? Well, because this was China, there was quite a tendency among the monks to just want to memorize sayings and spout them for others to be impressed with. Skin bag is another one of these old words you come across in the old texts, referring to this self. Nevertheless, there is a genuine expedient that is very good, though only experienced seekers will be able to focus doubt on it. It is like when Xuanzha, he was a great master at the time, it was like when Xuanzha was going to give a talk on the teaching one day, but didn't speak a single word, no matter how long the assembly stood there. Finally, they began to leave in twos and threes. Xuanzha remarked, "Look, today I have really helped them, but not a single one gets it. If I start flapping my lips, though, they immediately crowd around." And then Wu Men says, "You come here seeking expedient techniques, seeking doctrines, seeking peace and happiness. I have no expedient techniques to give people, no doctrine, no method of peace and happiness. Why? If there is any expedient technique, it has the contrary effect of burying you and trapping you." So he's warning here about attachment to techniques. This is one of the traps of Zen practice, and Sesshin is getting preoccupied with techniques, the technique of breathing or the technique of how to work with the koan, getting preoccupied with posture excessively, becomes a real hindrance. Very common, though, at a certain point, especially when you feel you're floundering in Sesshin, you're lost, you don't know what else to do, you're trying as hard as you can. It's common enough to think if only there were some little last detail of instruction, some nuance that I haven't heard yet, some little technical tweaking, then I'd get it. But no. Luckily, we don't have to be concerned with techniques in this practice beyond just knowing how to sit in a way of a good alignment, relaxed but straight, stable. Beyond that, it's all a matter of heart. It's a matter of just pouring yourself into the practice. More and more fully, more and more fully in the practice. In other words, it's not really in the realm of right and wrong. Techniques are in the realm of right and wrong. Doing it right, doing it wrong. There are, of course, little things that we can benefit from hearing, posture adjustments, or other little things, but 90% of it is just spirit or heart. Then he says, of old it was said, enlightenment is always with people, but people subjectively pursue things. Grasping at objects, mental objects mostly. This is how most people waste time, grasping at thoughts. In a sutra it says, if you can turn things around, they are the same as realization of suchness. And then he says, but how can things be turned around? He's also said, all appearances are unreal. If you see appearances are not inherent characteristics, then you see realization of suchness. And then he says, just step back, stop mental machinations, and look closely. When suddenly you see, nothing can stop you. When he says step back, and he says this over and over in this text, step back, of course, means not get caught in the objects of the mind. How do we do that? Well, we do it by absorbing ourselves in the practice, the breath or the koan. Noticing. That's how we notice. We step back mentally. We notice when we are enmeshed in something in the mind, a fantasy, a concern, a daydream. As long as we're in the middle of it, we can't see it. Stepping back, we recognize what's going on. We see the process, and then we're free. And it can be anything, any conditions, anything that's going on in the mind. Anxiety of any number of kinds of anxiety, fear, anger, sorrow. These are all states of mind that so long as we can just suddenly catch ourselves and realize them as states of mind, what in the early Buddhist texts call mental formations, these are all mental formations, motions, feelings, thoughts, all phenomena, a kind of a parade of phenomena that moves through us. We can detach ourselves enough to see it as this phantasmagoria of stuff arising in the mind, existing for a shorter or longer period, and then moving on, passing away. This is when we really become free of all of our conditioning. All realms of existence are there because of the deluded mind. Right now, how could they not be there? once you realize they are not there, they cannot delude your feelings and certainly cannot do anything to you. It is necessary to attain the reality where there is no delusion and no enlightenment before you can become free and unfettered. Once you realize they are not there, that is, once you realize that your delusions have no substance to them, you're free of them. They're there, but not there. That's the paradox. So one of the most famous statements in Zen is, from the very beginning, there has never been a single thing. Realizing this through one's own experience is awakening. Realizing that from the very beginning, there's never been a single thing. How can that be? What kind of sense does that make? There's never been a single thing. We look around, there are all kinds of things. People, cushions, candles, figures, trees. What do you mean there's never been a single thing? We may get to a point where we can intellectually kind of wrap our minds around this, but that won't do it. We have to see for ourselves in our bodies. There, this world of form is no other than the world of emptiness. The Zen school is called the school of Kashyapa's great absorption in quiescence. I never have heard that phrase, but okay. Without stirring a thread, all is understood. Without stirring a hair, all is realized. What is meant by this? All is understood. All is realized. Do not rouse the mind or stir thoughts throughout the 24 hours of the day, and you should be able to comprehend everything. This is called being a member of Kashyapa's school. Only then can you enter great absorption in quiescence. Kashyapa is one of the seven non-historical Buddhas. It's one of the names, the first few names we chant in the ancestral line. Now, what is there that acts as a mental object and an obstruction? Although people can investigate, people can study, they cannot understand by stirring thoughts. When you encounter a situation or hear a saying, if your thoughts stir, your mind gets excited and you make up an interpretation. In any case, you are in a scattered state. This is why you cannot understand by stirring thoughts. This is why it is essential in practice to not try to figure anything out. You can't figure it out. Things that are beyond our discriminating minds, our intellects, how could you possibly figure it out? in using the tools of the intellect, don't need to figure out anything. We just need to let thoughts settle. Stop messing with them. Leave them alone. Stop fighting them. We don't want to do anything with thoughts. Just put all of our attention in the practice. And in this way, thoughts settle on their own. And everything becomes clear. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.